Man, oh man, that intro is just getting better every week. Welcome, one and all, to the next episode, the newest episode of Wheest World, where nothing can go. Ooh, that's another gag. Hey, so today's episode, oh man, I've been looking forward to this. I look forward to all of them, but this one is very special. This is a good friend of mine. We don't get to see each other nearly enough. This was a special occasion. It's my man, Alex Iles, master trombonist, multiple genres, all kinds of disciplines. Wow, just a glance at his website, Alex Iles, that's I-L-E-S, alexilestrombone.com. Just glance at it, go to biography, and it says movie, television, recordings, movie and television recordings, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., great show, Alien versus Predator, Requiem, American Dad, Anchorman, what? Animaniacs, that's a hell of a lot of work there. Aquaman, Avatar 1 and 2. But then at the bottom it says click for all titles. Click that bad boy open and what? It seems like Thuzen, Batman versus Superman, Battlestar Galactica, The Dictator, Dreamgirls, Gone Girl, Gypsy, Hangovers, he's done everything, Lost, The Mandalorian. Man, so in the realm of film, he's been on the tracks, the soundtracks conducted by greats, John Williams, Hans Zimmer, James Horner, The Cats, The Justice League of composing for film, and Alex has been right there. He's also a symphonic trombonist. In 2002 specifically, he was appointed principal trombonist with the Long Beach Symphony Orchestra. He's played with Los Angeles Philharmonic, Pasadena Symphony, LA Chamber Orchestra. What? And 2014 he became a regular member of the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. Man. And that's literally scratching the surface, as they say. In the world of jazz, he's been with everybody. My man, Maynard Ferguson, Woody Herman, the list goes on and on. Tom Kubis's band, Bob Florence, the incredible Dave Sonicker band. That's an all-star who's who deluxe. And we're going to hear from a lot of that in the lightning round. So, you know what? I could go on and on forever about this man's credentials. But let's dive right in and talk to the human being himself. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Alex Iles. Hey, everybody, look. It's Alex Iles. Look at that. What's up?
Hey, my friend. What's that? Oh, you know, I have to apologize for this audience. That's really loud. I think there must be some, some fans of people who can play bass, tenor, and big tenor or something. I don't know.
Maybe it's because you had a really good warm-up comment before the show.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, he was actually incredible. I've never heard the Aristocrats told with such flair.
Oh, God.
Woo! Oh, well.
Moving right along.
Moving along quickly. Oh, man, that stopped the audience cold. I think it was a collective gasp. Yeah. Oh, man. So here we are with Alex Iles, one of my favorite people that I don't get to see nearly enough. And oh, man, thanks. We're going to do the deep dive into Ilesian bliss is what we're going
to
do.
Before we get to me, let me just say something about you, Steve, for a moment.
Uh-oh, okay.
Our initial contact, of course, was when you were you finally decided to leave Maynard's band.
Right.
1985, and I had sort of heard through the grapevine that there was going to be an opening, and I remember I hastily put together a little recording to send to you to to give to Maynard and stuff.
I remember that.
I'm so grateful that our contact was so positive and great, and you were told me the good news that I was going to be replacing you, which was also very intimidating to be.
Oh man,
Bill, with all the stuff that you'd done on that band for all that time, but it was a real thrill for me to get to come in after you'd gone and get to have one of the greatest experiences of my life. It was a couple of years that I got to play with I really do appreciate it. I never forget how wonderful that was. Now it's a long time ago, but I'm still very grateful to you for having given me the thumbs up to pass me on to your old gig. So I'm doing that, and I'm forever grateful to you for that. So thank you very much, Steve.
Well, it's truly my honor, man. I tell you what, and it was slam dunk. I forget what was on the tape, but when I played it, it was like, ooh, let me go get boss. And I suddenly felt all comfortable about leaving because I knew it was in good hands. So
it was a lot of fun. Yeah, it was great. It was really
good. Man, yeah.
And that's... we've only gotten to play a couple times since then.
Yeah, the big Dave Bagnosius thing.
Out in Texas. That was great. We gotta do that again sometime, I bet.
Oh, man, I hope so. That was so much fun. And yeah. I appreciate your very practical advice. So there was this beautiful piece that was written that featured the three of us, you and myself and Bill Reichenbach, of course. And there was what was for me an unplayable moment in there. And I kept shedding it and shedding it, and it was driving me nuts. And you said, "Yeah, why don't you rewrite it?" And so I did, and I liked it better. And we played it, and it was great.
I don't like too, so why not?
I don't think anybody noticed except that it went by. So
fun. That was a really really fun experience. Yeah,
it really was. And Doc Marcellus was there too. I got to see him, so that was wonderful.
Yeah.
That was a great hang, talking about TCU, what was their trombone summit or something they called it. And it was Alex and myself and Bill Reichenbach. And Bill saved me a lot of pain, literally. He turned me on to the ice machine for a knee replacement.
Ah.
Because he had like two at once. You know, it's a show with people of a certain age when we talk.
That's what it's all about, yeah.
Our sponsor is titanium knee replacement ice machine.
AARP.
Yes. Brought to you by AARP.
Oh, boy.
Oh, man. It has come to this. But that was, he turned me on to that. And, man, it was within 2 weeks, I was walking a mile. So
great.
Good that's you. My man, St. William. Is he coming out to... LA, does he come out still?
A while. He's pretty settled out there in North Carolina now. He's having a nice time, and he loves his place out there. He comes out for certain sessions, or there's maybe a concert or something that he really wants to do. He'll come out and see his old buddies out here. And we have a big band recording coming up with Dave Sloniker's big band. He's probably
gonna come out with that. Man, what a band that is.
So we just played a concert last night, actually. We played a great concert, and and it was great. It was really great. Dave is a phenomenal writer, of course.
Yeah,
trombonist, so of course he knows how to write really great trombone parts. And so we've just I love that band. The players are great, you know, fantastic.
Oh, it's an all-star group, man, I tell you. And the
drums, and this wonderful trombonist, great trombone section with me and Charlie Morales, and now Ido Meshulam, who's
He's something else, man.
Either usually Bill's there, but if he's not there, we have Paul Nelson, who's another great
musician in
this town, and it's just a blast. It's a really, really great thing.
Well, I will. I'll break the rules and give away some of the suspense. One of the lightning round choices is from Convergence. I bet you know which one it is. So you know it has to be that track. So. Man, okay. Well, I'll pretend. I'll edit that out so there's much surprise still.
Oh, we want to do that. Yeah.
I gave it away. Oh, man, oh man. So here we go. We're going to do the deep dive. It begins with Alex Begins. Did you begin in Arcadia? I mean, it was southern part of California, but whereabouts?
That's right. Just a little outside of downtown Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Arcadia is its nickname was the City of Homes.
Ooh.
So my parents moved there because of the school system. My parents originally from New Zealand. And they moved around quite a bit the first few years they were together. They lived in Canada for a while. That's where my sister was born. And they lived in England for a while. And my dad eventually found work here. He was a physicist. So he found work doing solar photovoltaics, solar cells.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He worked for a company in the City of Industry down here. And he would commute from Arcadia to that place. And we had a great school system with an excellent music program, a public school music program. My sister was a violinist. She's 4 years older.
She was a violinist.
And she, she was having so much fun playing music. I thought I'd like to play too. And I wasn't sure what instrument to play. So my mom went to meet with the orchestra conductor, which they had a little meeting with all the moms every year, you know, with the graders.
And it was orchestra.
Yeah, he was an orchestra conductor, but I was probably going to go into the band, probably. Mm-hmm. But I went, and this is the world's shortest conversation. My mom met with Mr. Ken Wydaw, who was kind of a wonderful educator. And Mr. Wydaw said, "So, Mrs. Isles, tell me about your son." And she said, "Well, he's quite tall." And Mr. Wydaw said, "He's going to play trombone." And that was it. So that night
there
I went out and bought, somebody had a trombone, a Olds Ambassador for sale. So I brought it home and started messing around with it. And then I started studying in a little class with three or four other up and coming newbies. And we met in a little hollowed out classroom that they dedicated to do that. And we sort of played there, and then we got thrown into the little junior band. And I just started playing in the band for the rest of elementary school, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade.
Oh man, that's great that you started. That's kind of early. I mean, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was into it. I wouldn't say that it was my primary focus, sports, and I was into school and doing other things. Music and stuff was a big part of my life. And then, but when I got to high school, by the time I got to middle school, actually, I started getting more into it.
Yeah.
And I actually started taking private lessons with a guy in high school. He was a senior in high school. So he was like 17 and I was like 13. And his name is Jim Feichman. I'm still in touch with him.
How cool. That's great.
And he had studied with a great teacher in the area, and had a really nice routine, you know, of all the fundamentals, warming up and long tones and building your range and Arban, Roshu, and all that stuff. So I had lots of things to practice. And then one day, like I remember it like it was yesterday, he brought over some records. Some albums, some big band albums, and some trombone records. He brought over a J.J. Johnson record, Irby Green record, the first Bill Watrous album, and then he brought over some other orchestral albums with like Strauss tone poems and.
Oh man!
So I was just thrown into this thing, and so that it was like, you know, when addicts talk about, you know, getting their first fix, and they that was exactly what happened with me. I immediately was going to the record store almost every week after that, trying to find stuff and going to use record stores and trying to find.
Oh man.
So that really got me going. Yeah.
When he gave you the Irby album, did he say, "All right, the first one's free, man"?
I was just hooked. And and back then we had to order the records from the record store and wait, you know?
Yeah.
And so I really loved that whole process. So listening became a real big part of me. We didn't really have a jazz band in my high school. So I was always just listening.
Wow.
And then later on, I got to play in the Pasadena Boys Club, had a jazz band. I played there with a few people and who I still play with now. And
really? Oh, how cool. Yeah,
I was always sort of on the periphery. I was messing around a little with improvising, but I was not very serious about it at all. I never serious about then by the time I got to college, I went to UCLA, and I was not a music major in school. I actually studied economics in school. But
that's right, I remember that. Sure.
Department was set up there at that time. They didn't really have a big emphasis on performance. It was academic stuff, musicology, music education. But we had performing groups, and they needed trombone players. So most of us in the groups were non-majors. And I played all the groups there, jazz band, orchestra, wind ensemble. And I was doing it just because it was fun, and I really loved it. And my freshman year of college, I auditioned for the Disney All-American College Band. I got into that out here in California, and that we really did a deep dive that summer in the music business and playing every day and, you know, getting a feel for that and meeting people. Matter of fact, one of the people I met in that group was named Dan Levine. He's a wonderful trombonist in New York.
There you go.
He was actually the one later on who was the one who mentioned the Maynard gig to me later on. So
talking about
network, you know, simple networking, that was the most basic thing. Yeah. And Dan and I are good friends to this day. That was 1980. We've been good friends since 1980.
Wow. And
so that got my feet wet. I was really enjoying that. And then, you know, I went to Aspen School of Music a couple summers, but it was always in the summer that I concentrated on practicing and playing mostly. During the school year, I was primarily trying to just keep my grades up to get out of college.
Right, right.
And then I did odd jobs when I got out of college. I was playing a little bit. I started studying with a wonderful trombone teacher who passed away about 15 years ago, named Roy Main, who taught all the freelancers that I grew up playing with. Bob McChesney, Andy Martin, Alan Kaplan, Bob Sanders, all the freelance players who were either just started ahead of me or were around at my time. We all studied with Roy, and he was a great teacher. He himself was a fine freelance, you know, player, on bass trombone real well. He could sit in an orchestra. He played in a jazz band. He played with Les Brown for many years. And
so that was kind of a through an idea, an ID fix in your life, is that you've always been around people that are doing everything, not just one type of music.
Kind of the nature of things out here, and most of the jobs that come up are of different things. It's really hard to be one kind of player in Los Angeles. You know, it's not enough of one thing. Unless you're in the LA Philharmonic, you can play in an orchestra, but you know, it's pretty tough otherwise. And then when you get into even things like studio work, a lot of the time, especially back 20, 30 years ago, we didn't know what kind of music we were going to play on any given day.
Wow.
It could be anything. So you had to be kind of like, so as I started getting into, you know, that music and that whole musical world, and I'm going out listening to great players like Charlie Loper and getting to and all these wonderful players that were around. And
everybody says Charlie Loper was like the cat that everybody wanted to be.
There was always something about his sound and his feel. He had he was the consummate lead big band lead trombonist. I've never sat next to someone on a regular basis that I felt any more respect for, you know, and just completely walking away. We'd all talk about it. I remember going to do rehearsals with Andy Martin.
Yeah.
And we'd just sit there and I said, I just rehearsed with Charlie this morning, and there'd be this moment of silence and we just shake our heads and go, what is about Charlie? Why is he so good? And so we even tried to imitate how he sat. Like we tried.
Right.
One foot in front of another. Just to see if that makes a difference. Charlie sits like this. Let's see if it makes a difference. So
yeah,
and I both did that. It didn't make any difference. We thought maybe it would, but you know, he's just he had this beautiful, pure sound.
Yeah.
He's playing beautiful phrasing, great times, always right in the pocket. What I describe it as, you know, when you're playing in a section with him, he just lays a big target. You know, you just don't play anything wrong when you're playing with him. It's just so easy. You just go right.
Wow. Yeah, oh, anyway. That's the ultimate goal of playing lead right there.
Yeah. And he very rarely said anything about the way the music should go. Cause it was, if you didn't get it, you didn't get it. I mean, you had to be
right.
He was always really great and funny guy. Great. Wonderful personality on the job. You know, sometimes we'd be in less than ideal circumstances, especially in the recording studio, a lot of pressure and a lot of time constraints and stuff. And Charlie was just always really, you know, he always stayed calm and collected and right on focus. And yeah, he's inspiring. I still feel very inspired by him to this day. You know,
what a role model. Yeah.
Yeah. He was a great role model. He and Alan Kaplan and Dick Nash so many players that were wonderful role models for me. We're so lucky. And even players my own age, Andy Martin, McChesney, was here.
Yeah.
I've never had a shortage of, and now with all these great new players coming up, that no shortage of role models around here. But
After
I got out of college, I actually interviewed for a job with an insurance company.
Really?
And, and it was kind of a freak, a little accident. I took a series of exams and I did well on them, which I never usually did that well on standardized tests, but I got three tests and they started to offer me the job, and I sort of paused and said, well, how much flexibility is there in this job?
Right, and right.
The guy interviewing me was kind of perplexed. So what do you mean? I said, well, is there flexibility? Or, you know, how much time off would I get in a year? They said, well, you get 2 weeks vacation and 2 weeks sick pay. I said, 4 weeks. Wow.
Oh,
nice. And then, so I took a deep breath and I said something to a stranger I'd never said in my life at that point. I was like 23 years old.
Yeah.
I said, the reason I'm asking is I'm a musician. That's the first time I'd ever identified myself.
Oh.
And the guy was so nice. He just went, well, that's interesting. I think maybe you should think about this. Why don't you talk to your family this weekend and think about this job and talk about, you know, some of your goals. I think this is worth thinking about. No pressure. Just let's talk next week. Over the weekend, wow. My teacher called me up and said, hey, I just got a call from Ira Napes, another one of my great role models of great jazz. He's lived in L.A., in L.A. And Ira said they were looking for a trombone player for a cruise ship job. So I said, and Roy asked me, do you have your passport up to date? I said, yeah. He's all, do you want to do this job? I said, yes. So I called back this wonderful guy who interviewed me and said, I'm really sorry, but I really appreciate your time, but I'm going to go do this thing, you know, and I'm on this cruise ship for 4 months. And he said, you know what? That's great. I'm really happy for you. That's, you made your decision. That's fine. You know, much rather you do that than take this job and be miserable after a year or something. And
wow.
Yeah. He was very cool. Very nice guy. So,
That's one of those landmark moments in a life, you know, the big decision.
Yeah, definitely. I think some people are not lucky enough to have that kind of fork in the road moment. You know,
I was
really lucky that I was confronted. I had to make a decision.
Yeah.
It was clear. Anyway, so that was that. And then I just, when I came back from the ship, I was struggling and, you know, just trying to get into the freelance thing. And not long after that, it's when I had the opportunity to go out with Maynard.
Wow. I
did that for years. And then I had John Fedchock and Paul McKee left Woody Herman's band.
Right.
They hired myself and John Allred to go do Woody's band right after that. So that was
A great section too.
Favorite bands growing up to play in, you know, as a dream, you know, were Maynard's band and Woody's band. I always loved, I followed those two bands like the Yankees or something, you know, when I was
right.
A kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go out and have that experience on the road with those.
Wow. So how long were you with Woody?
About a year. You know, we did a couple off and on. And then when he'd come through town, sometimes if they, you know, they sometimes do runouts to L.A., they'd be out of, you know, John Fedchock would come and I'd be able to play in the section with him or whatever. And there'd be like maybe four or five players. And then they pick up other guys other players in L.A.
Oh, okay.
So but it was, some of those, they do little tribute concerts to Woody after he passed away and
sure.
had to do a few of those. And it was just, it's always fun to go back.
Well, what a two beautiful people to hook up with, you know, for the first and a lot of people talk about. Oh. I heard a little bit about a little bit of the thing you did with Mike Davis on the Bone to Pick, and the point that always comes up, you know, folks of our generation is how fortunate we were to grab the tail end of that stuff, you know. Just
really, what it really was. I mean, having grown up listening to it, so it had context when we got the opportunity.
Right.
It was really, we're very lucky. It's really true. And I really do feel for a lot of the great younger musicians coming up now that there are fewer and fewer of those kind of opportunities where you get to play your horn every day. You know, maybe not for the best money, but you're doing it. You're doing it every day.
And best education ever. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you have to play no matter how you feel. You know,
great
you
point.
You know, and it's so hard. You're not getting graded, you know,
right.
You're not getting credit, you know, you're just getting up there and you have to play because it's your paycheck.
Right.
And there's an audience there that want to hear you play.
That's the thing, man. Learning. That was what I thought of as the University of Maynard Ferguson was learning how to relate to an audience and how to work that. You know, it's
how many times did he do stuff in front of an audience that you just go, oh, you know, every week he'd do something. That I felt was something worth learning. And
absolutely. What an entertainer and a communicator is. Yep. Forget very it, natural. Man.
Yeah. Yep. Charisma, stage presence, just putting a set together, just putting together a set
right.
so he could feature himself and feature the band and get up to that really exciting point and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's it's a little show busy, right, for a lot of people. But I still think there's some lessons there that even if you're a if you're a real dedicated artist in any direction, there's something there to learn from that.
Oh, absolutely. Just how to handle yourself on a mic and introduce people. It's it was a tradition of communication with the audience, like a symbiotic thing that was so great.
For both of us, I know for you and for me, just learning from the other people in the band, you know.
Huge. So good, you know, huge.
You get Priest up there, you know, I was up Maynard with Wayne and Rick Marnitza. Yeah. And it was a great band. And I just hear some of these people play every night was just inspiring.
You know, yeah.
I feel like it was really, it revealed a certain standard of excellence, individual excellence that, you know, you don't get. You just kind of see somebody, everyone, once in a while, when you're in a bus and you're on stage and you're always hanging out with these people, there's so much that you just go, oh my gosh, how much depth to this musician.
Right. And you see how they prepare, how they live each day, when they're writing, you know, when it was myself and Dennis and Dennis de Blasio and Chris Braman and Tim Reese and everybody had the little keyboards and we were all plugging into each other's keyboards. What are you working on? You know? And
yeah, that's great. The lab.
What is that voicing? That's the best.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, you learn from each other so much.
Yeah.
So much that way. Yeah. It's really great. It's like a lab, you know, it really is literally.
Yeah. Living the lab experience. And there's many opportunities for the young artists nowadays, especially the ability to create your own scene and hybrid things, combining different musics and the even playing field of technology and all of that.
Yeah.
But man, we got a little piece of magic with that stuff.
Yeah. It was really nice. Cause it was very personal, you know, that was nice. But like you said, I mean, there's people are doing the things that people that are that age now, and they're maybe, I'm thinking like early 20s, just out of school, early 20s to like 30 in that era, that the creativity, the amount of creativity and unique sounds and personal sounds I'm hearing are spectacular.
Me too.
I mean, yeah, there might be fewer trombone players in the world than there were maybe 50 years ago.
Right.
But the level keeps going up every year.
I know. Man, we could have talked for another 3 hours at least, and we almost did. So I'm going to divide this one up into two parts, just like we did with Steve Turay. It seems when trombone players get together, I mean, we can solve the problems of the universe with a smile on our face. That's just how it works. Comedians in cars getting coffee has nothing on musicians on a Zoom call talking about everything. But there you have it. So that's the end of part one. Part two will include more on the greatness that is Alex Iles. His playing, his daily routine, some pedagogy, and a couple other very cool things. A lot of stories, studio stories, etc., etc., as well as the lightning round. Yeah, we get into four cuts that represent Alex's very fine playing, you know, out of 10 million that we could choose from. So I just grabbed four randomly, and Alex discusses them, and you'll get to hear them, all of that and more, on part two with Alex Iles. Until then, you've been listening to the legendary Wiest World podcast, and we'll see you not very long from now for part two of Alex Iles. Bye.
WCBC Wiest World.
Wiest World is a production of Wiest World Productions 2025. That's as fast as I can talk.